Good afternoon. Welcome back to The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. I am Mike Deason.
This is Lorene Jaffe.
And I hope everybody had a nice 4th of July holiday.
Yeah, celebrating freedom, eating too much. Grateful for the freedoms we do have when we see what's going on around the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. We have a packed show for you today. And we're going to start out with something new. It's a feature we're calling News for Jews. And we think that we should start off each program talking about issues that affect Jewish citizenry and what's going on in our country and nationally. And the first topic we want to talk about is something that, Lorene, you talked about on our last program that I was quite shocked about, and that's white national college recruitment for nationalists who are against Jews is on the rise for the third straight year, according to the Anti-Defamation League. It's shocking to me.
Well, you know, I think what's frightening is we saw what was happening at USF. We see the increase in participation of two white nationalist groups there, the intimidation of Jewish college students. I assume the same thing's happening for other minorities on that campus, that they're being intimidated. But you see the ADL report, which was very surprising, said there was a 77% increase, over 300 incidents in the 2018-2019 school year. And that was a tremendous increase from the season past. So
a 77% increase. That is shocking.
Right. That they're out there recruiting students to join them. That's frightening, actually. It's shocking but frightening.
It is. And quite frankly, before we started doing this show, I had no idea. You talked last week a little bit about some of the incidents at USF with Hillel, having swastikas put on it. We certainly know that anti-Semitism is rising throughout the country and right here in the Tampa Bay area. So this is something we cannot ignore. And if you weren't aware, like I wasn't, you should be aware, because I don't know what we do to counteract it. That's the problem. What do we do to counteract it?
Well, I think the one positive thing that we can do in the state of Florida, I was really grateful for the Florida House passed that bill this year that the governor signed into law when he was in Israel, which makes anti-Semitism in particular, by definition, it makes it unlawful in the public school systems. That would include the Florida universities. So to the extent that these white supremacist groups are on campus and are spreading anti-Semitic or other propaganda that displays racism, I think that students now have an avenue against those organizations. If those are students, then certainly they are now at risk of being in violation of Florida law. And that's something that will fall on the Florida Attorney General and others to prosecute, and we hope that they will. But those college campuses should be a safe place. They should be a safe haven for our kids when we send them off to school. And I'm really happy to see that. So I despite the great rise in the 2018-2019 school year, I hope at least in Florida, with that new law, that we're going to see that number actually reverse.
And you would hope that the universities would take part in bringing this to light, bringing it to Ashley Moody, the Attorney General. I mean, I'm sure that when Judy Genshaft was at USF, because she's Jewish, she certainly would have done that. We don't know what the new president is going to be like, but we would have to hope that everyone involved at USF would bring this to the attention of the Attorney General's office. And we expect to be talking to Ashley Moody in the next couple of weeks. That is an issue we will definitely talk about.
Absolutely. I think we assume that the universities know what to do in those situations. And quite frankly, we have some very specific examples where students have been subjected to very gross anti-Semitic conduct. And quite frankly, the universities didn't know what to do. And the students felt like that they were treated unjustly, that justice wasn't served, that those students weren't properly disciplined for their conduct, or those professors weren't properly disciplined. So, you know, I think there is some education that needs to happen on the part of the universities with their professors and others, and sort of what to do when it is reported. How do you respond?
Certainly USF for years had problems dating back to Sammy L. Arian, goes so far back. But there was basically what people considered a terrorist cell operating out of USF. Now, I've got to tell you, I covered that trial. the United States had a terrible case. Mm-hmm. They got one pity verdict for them, but they put on a terrible case. And I think that El Arian stood for things that we don't believe in. I don't think the U.S. proved it. I thought they could put together. That personally, I thought he was railroaded. Even though I disagreed with him, mm-hmm. the U.S. did a terrible job with that case.
Prosecuting
the case. They could have prosecuted, on stronger things, but I'm not an attorney. You are. But I was sitting there as a courtroom observer, and it was a terrible case. Speaking of cases, about a week or so ago, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled, had two big rulings as they closed out their session. And the one that struck me as interesting was the gerrymandering case. And the reason it's relevant in News for Jews is because the three Jewish justices all voted in the minority position and thought that the court was wrong in not accepting the case. It really sparked a strong opinion from Elena Kagan, who wrote the dissent, and then Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, excuse me, were all on the minority side of the case. But I guess that's not overly surprising because they tend to vote with the liberal side of the court. Or,
well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as a lawyer, I would just say that I think Americans don't really appreciate on a day-to-day basis what happens at the U.S. Supreme Court. For the most part, the justices actually have a wonderful relationship. There often is not this clear divide between what, you know, in American society today we call conservative and liberal lines on the court. You see justices all the time aligning with each other on different issues, and which I think would surprise most Americans if they actually looked at the recorded decisions and those statistics. But
Ginsburg and Scalia were best friends.
Oh yeah,
and they were on the opposite ends of many cases, but they respected each other.
Absolutely,
respected their opinions, even though they said you're wrong.
right.
But they really got along. So
yeah. But I thought that. But I am glad to see that, you know, that I think Kagan's had a very strong voice. This isn't the first opinion in the last year or so where she's had a very strong voice. And I think it's reflective of coming from a minority population that's been discriminated against. I think she brings a very clear viewpoint to the court, and I think we'll see a lot more from her.
I agree. I agree 100%. Another story that really touched me, that it's just a great reaching out in the preaching of peace, is the rabbi from Poway, California, where the shooting took place, spoke to the UN about a week ago, and he had part of his finger shot off.
Right.
And he said that the way to fight anti-Semitism is with love.
Yes.
I mean, that's just a wonderful thought. Hard to do, but hate begets hate. And a man who had a person in his congregation killed said random acts of goodness and kindness light the world. And that's what we're taught in Torah.
That's exactly right. I think that's the foundation of Jewish life. I mean, that is Torah. We're supposed to be a light to the world. And that's the chassid, that's the loving kindness, it's the justice and the way we're supposed to treat each other. I think it's so important. And when you confront hate in a way that hate's not expecting, when you confront it with kindness and love, that's really the only way you can change the
and
world.
You know what also he did? He took out a tzedakah box and put some coins in it. It was just such great symbolism. And he says, every morning, think about helping others. Man, what a great world we would have if people would think like that.
Right. Start your day off with that. You know, you're having a cup of coffee. Let's give some charity and let's think about how we can make it better today.
But it's very hard to do with people who hate you,
yeah.
People who shoot you. It's easier said than done.
Absolutely.
But you got to give him credit, and we could all use a little of that thought, but I don't, man.
He was also talking to a very tough audience. You're talking to an audience, the United Nations, that is predominantly anti-Semitic and has been very
Certainly anti-Israel.
Anti-Israel, biased against Israel, very, and in many ways. I mean, that's where the anti-Israel bias turns into anti-Semitism, because it is so extreme. And I think that, so he's in front of a very difficult audience, you know, extending, you know, an olive branch.
Excellent. Just an excellent thing to do. Another thing that you and I were talking about before the show that we want to talk about is the Trump peace plan.
Yes, yes. Peace, what is it? Peace to prosperity. Peace right. to prosperity. Yeah, so there was this, there's still a lot to read and a lot of, you know, I haven't gone through the plan myself personally, but I did watch a lot of videos and I tried to read a bunch of articles. But I found one piece I thought was the most interesting. It was from that Palestinian reporter. It was in the Eurasia news article on June 27th by Ray Hananiah. He's a Palestinian reporter. And he actually had a very interesting take. I mean, I think the American media was very critical, but I spent a lot of time with Al Jazeera. I spent a lot of time looking at reporters outside the country. And, you know, at the end of his piece, he said, just for once, couldn't we as Palestinians set aside the failed policies of rejectionism and try something else? Maybe walk the narrow passageways of hope rather than manage to make ourselves the outsiders in a forum that is all about us. And I, you know, that just really hit me because I listened to, you know, over hundreds of investors from around the world. I listened to world leaders. And I'm not just talking about the United States, world leaders. And you had with Christine Lagarde from the IMF, you had the head of the World Bank there. You had the head of the Bank of Africa there. You had some very significant players as well as the relevant Arab neighbors of the Palestinian people who would be there to support them, you know, from Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the UAE, et cetera. And they were there to express a message of hope and really had this plan of investment to help startups, to help to create jobs. And just when I was listening to this, I was really in the sincerity of these people. So, you know, maybe you don't like Trump and maybe you don't think he has sincerity, but the other people that were there, that's really what struck me. Tony Blair struck me in his sincerity.
The only thing is, and the critics say, is that you can't have a peace plan based on money, even $50 billion, which is a lot of money, obviously, but that there's got to be a peace plan that comes first because the feeling is even if they got the money and then there's war or terrorism and it's blown up all the businesses, it goes to no good. And that's where the critics in the United States come in that said the plan just, it was a monetary plan. It didn't have the peace element.
Right. And so, and by the way, there is some validity to that when you look at the fact that the international community put in $4 billion between 2012 and 2016 into Gaza and the Palestinian Authority. But the problem with it and what makes this different is that, you know, that you're not just getting the money, right? We're not just going to hand you the money. You have to do something to get it. There's a reward that's associated with it. If you demonstrate that you're going to do the following and you put certain things in place, then, you know, there's steps to it and what you can get. And so some of the things were grants for a bunch of products, including grants projects like startups, new cargo terminals, this concept of the infrastructure of this cargo terminal between the West Bank and Gaza, specific grants for border crossing, infrastructure for universities and hospitals and other things. So it was the idea of sort of it's not just a blanket check, there's specific designation on how this is going to be spent. And then if you do certain things and there's more money that will be released. And so, you know, I thought the Saudi foreign minister who is participating, and we all, you know, have plenty of criticism of Saudi Arabia. But the one thing that he said, which I thought was very interesting, one of the interviews was, he said, look, what's lacking right now is hope. You have a generation of young people in Gaza in particular, but throughout the Palestinian Authority, that an overwhelming majority of the population is under the age of 18. And you need to create hope because this is a generation that has grown up, you know, really in constant conflict. And he said the last time we saw hope in Gaza and we actually saw prosperity and great potential was 25 years ago, which would have been before the Intifada. And, you know, really, I think the biggest problem right now, and I agree with you, in Gaza is these kids, in essence, even though they're extraordinarily literate, I mean, their literacy rate is incredible, but they're literally under this I don't even have a positive word to say for Hamas. I mean, Hamas means extreme violence. It's a government that is an authoritarian rule, that's a dictator, that's a terrorist organization that's more interested in spending money on missiles and rockets and terror tunnels than infrastructure and hospitals and energy and schools. And it's just the overwhelming.
This same author wrote a December editorial saying that peace cannot come until the leaders stand up to the extremists, meaning Hamas, among others, that they will never have a peace plan as long as you have people intent on the destruction of Israel. And that Abbas is just turning a blind eye. And as you said, he's afraid of getting assassinated.
Of course.
You know, but that there has to be a realization that you have to come back toward the center. And same in Israel, too. I mean, you know, Netanyahu at times has been strident, to say the least, right?
Right.
So both sides have to come together if we want to establish peace.
Right. I've heard commentators and people who are far more sophisticated and knowledgeable than me who, you know, they work for think tanks and this is what they do for a living. And they've all said, you know, and not just them. I mean, I've had, there have been Democrats from this country who have gone and spent time in Ramallah. And they said the problem with it is that they're just lacking real leadership. And until, you know, Abbas, you know, is no longer in power and nobody really knows who's going to succeed him, but hopefully there will be someone in a younger generation that will say, listen, we're done with this. We're done with this, as this reporter said, we're done with this rejectionism. We're done with this. We want to try something different because all your policies so far have failed us. Let's try something different. Let's try, you know, reaching across the aisle. Let's try, you know, saying yes to investing in us versus investing in war and see if we could do something different. So I think that it's an extraordinary literate population. I think there's great potential there. And I think we just need to give them a glimmer of hope. I think if you see the youth sort of grasp onto that and they know that they can, that there's this hope that's like right in front of them, if they're hungry enough for it, you know, they'll rise up and push back upon the older generation that has always been about, you know, rejectionism and I think, you know, pushing towards peace.
Let's hope so.
But I hope so.
The story that shocked me more than anything this week is right here in the United States, where a survey from the Public Religion Research Institute said, ready for this? Nearly 20% of Americans say it's acceptable for business owners to refuse to serve Jews if doing so would violate their religious beliefs. I am
crazy.
I am astounded. That's up from in 2014, 12% thought that was okay. It just blows my mind. And this comes from among the largest Christian groups in America, including white evangelical Protestants, 12 to 24%. White mainline Protestants, 11 to 26%, and Catholics, 10% to 20%. Men more likely to agree with the idea than women. Republicans, 24% supported it more than Democrats, 17%. But that is just an astounding, astounding figure to think that people think it's all right to say, I don't want to do business. Now, there was the Supreme Court ruling about businesses not
the cake
ruling. I can't imagine that if this ever got to court, that the Supreme Court would rule that's okay. I mean, because it's the same thing like saying I don't want to serve blacks or Hispanics or whatever group that you're talking about.
Right.
But still, in all, 20%.
I'm trying because I read the case when it came out from the U.S. Supreme Court on the Baker, and I think the reason why they fell that way was because there was some other conversation at the lower court level that caused an issue. I think the court would have ruled differently had it been presented differently. So I think it was that ruling. I really believe was very specific to the facts in that case. What was surprising is I think you're looking at this and I was surprised by this because they also said that they would do the same thing, whether, you know, there's a certain group with, 30% said it was okay to refuse service to gay and lesbian people, 29% to transgender, 24% to atheists, and 22% to Muslims. And 15% of respondents said it would be acceptable to refuse service to African Americans on such grounds. That's shocking. I mean, it's not just Jews. It's pretty much every minority group that you can think that they're even saying that there's 15% of people who said that's okay.
There, you know, there's a lot of prejudice in this country. I mean, we as Jews think, well, okay, we're the target, but it extends to so many groups.
It's shocking and frightening, and I'm thinking, so I don't believe that if this actually got up to the Supreme Court again, and it was a different set of circumstances, different set of facts, I do think the Supreme Court would say, no, you can't do that. Sorry, that's discrimination. I'm pretty confident of that. So, because I do remember it was a very narrow holding. But this report is just something to keep us all in mind that we all have to be vigilant. And again, bigotry and hate is a learned value, and it's just about having communication and educating and conversation. And being willing to have those conversations with people.
Well, I think what we were going to do now is take a little break. We're going to come on back, and we've got some other things that I hope you'll be interested in. You are listening to The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. Welcome back. You're listening to The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. I'm Mike Deason.
This is Lorene Jaffe.
And we should say that this is a show about Jewish issues and Jewish values. And we're delighted to be here with you. Delighted that you are here with us.
On this 4th of July weekend. So if you haven't joined us before, this is The Third Opinion, and that's what we're doing.
That's right.
About issues that are related to the Jewish world, to Jewish life here in the country, around Israel, around the world. So we're really happy to have you.
We are. One of the things that we've had some emails, and let me say this, we're working on getting an email. This show is new, so we don't have an email here. I will give my own personal email. I don't have a problem with it. You know, it's email, okay? So we'll have one here at the station. But if you want to send me an email, if you're angry, because we've had a lot of angry emails, I'm fine with it. My email is deason.media@gmail.com. I used to get all sorts of emails at the TV station that were less than kind. So that's okay. Deason, D-E-E-S-O-N, .media@gmail.com. We're working on one here at WMNF. But anyhow, One of the criticisms from one of the emails we got, or a couple of them, was that we were just using a Jewish viewpoint and not giving any ability for people who aren't Jewish to express their opinions. Well, we want to counteract that, and we will in future programs. We had the opportunity to talk to two young men who are traveling the country. They're Israelis. One's Jonathan Ahori. And he is, he describes himself as an Israeli Christian. He left Lebanon several years ago, fled from Lebanon, moved to Israel. And then Ali Adi, who is describes himself as an Israeli Muslim. And the first question I asked him is, do non-Jews and do Jews get along in Israel?
Like, they do get along. Like, they live in one country.
Right.
It's going fine, I guess. Like, a democracy with its problems and with its pros and cons. But if you ask me what's the ideal situation would be, I want to see more integration of minorities inside the Jewish or the Israeli cultural society. Right now, if you go to Israel, you will see that there are cities that are separated by ethnic groups or religious groups. Like, people prefer to live with people who are similar to them, like closer to their beliefs or lifestyle. And people are happy with that. Like, it's a status quo. If you want, like, an ideal situation would be more integration, like less separated cities and more mixing.
Do you have friends that are Jewish?
I live in Tel Aviv, so my whole life is in the Jewish sphere. Hebrew, I speak Hebrew in a daily basis. I even speak it better than Arabic. I feel more comfortable with Hebrew. I speak Hebrew with my Arab friends, like we speak Hebrew, me and Jonathan.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's pretty interesting.
But I think it happens all around the world. It's just weird because it's in Israel, so you expect that people are more separated, that the Arabs will speak Arabic and the Jews will stick to the Hebrew.
When people talk about BDS, one of the big reasons that you guys are here, they think, well, we're just going to punish the Jews. But yeah. it would hurt you guys as well, would it not? Go ahead, Joe.
The BDS movement, its title is, to boycott, sanction Israel. But eventually it affects the minorities and the Palestinians more than it actually affects the Jewish people and the state of Israel. For example, one of the famous examples is that a company, SodaStream, that has to leave the West Bank because of the boycott, sanction and divestment movement. And eventually, once it left the West Bank, hundreds and thousands of Palestinians were actually, living their day-to-day life, going working beside Jews. It stopped. So now they're living at home, no jobs. It's not only affecting them personally, but affects their families. It affects their wider groups surrounding them. So they're just, the BDS movement, in my opinion, is an anti-Semitic organization that doesn't want Israel to exist at all. And they try to persuade it in a way that it's, it's for human rights. But eventually it's anti-Israeli, it's anti-Semitic, and they're just hurting the Palestinians more than actually the Israelis.
Do your Arab friends agree with that?
No. This is the answer. The absurd thing about the BDS is that they are targeting the side that is doing a positive effort to fix the problems, the conflict in Israel, which is absurd. Like, you are going to the people who are more peace-oriented and you attack them. So there's something that is really distorted here. There's a tendency to see that the Jews are the problem because they are the stronger side. But when you look at it from the inside, which what I see, you will see that the Arabs have a long way to do in order to also be part of the solution.
And that clearly is what is the answer, is to have both sides be part of the solution. But BDS, as we've talked before, and people in some of the emails we've received have said, how can you say that? It hurts the Palestinians. It hurts the Arabs much more than it hurts the Jewish population.
Right. And I think, and even in the sense of SodaStream, where it was located, you did, and there are other businesses that do this still, where, Jews and Arabs are working side by side in friendly peace. I mean, they're working together on factory lines and doing different things. And those Palestinians that are coming into work at those companies are actually getting better salaries and better benefits than they would at other businesses inside the Palestinian Authority. So it's really a very direct negative impact, and it doesn't help them. It's not pursuing peace. It's not pursuing human rights. I think, these are people that, and I get it. I think that a lot of people who end up supporting the movement, they really care about human rights and they think it's the right thing to do. One of the questions I always ask is, how have you spent time over there? I mean, have you really spent time and not just going to the people you're told to go talk to, but actually just go talk to people that are working in some of these businesses over there and ask them how it's affecting their families? I mean, there's actually tremendous prosperity in the Palestinian Authority. I mean, this last time I was there, and I've been in the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank multiple times, and this last time I spent some time in Bethlehem, and I'm over at the ministry office, and there's Bentleys, and there's Mercedes, and there's like very expensive cars all surrounding me, and very wealthy businessmen that are doing very well. I mean, so there is prosperity over there. I think that the frustrating part, though, is for the youth that feel like they've got the ceiling on them of being forced into this rejectionism, mindset of their leadership, and they're hungry, they're desperate for something. And in Gaza is a whole different situation. I mean, it's horrific what's happening over in Gaza. And I think that a lot of people are very quick to point the finger at Israel always. You know, and I sort of think of, okay, so let's say you live in Tampa Bay, right? And you've got your neighbor, St. Pete, and St. Pete decided, I'm going to shoot over 700 rockets into Tampa. Some of them might land in South Tampa, some of them might land in Carrollwood, some Wesley Chapel, Westies, whatever. But I'm sending them over just, you know, in a matter of 24 hours. And whoever I hit, I hit. I mean, that's the mentality and the life of, that's reality on the ground in Israel. Right. That's coming out of Gaza. Like that's, and the terror tunnels that they're building, instead of using money and the concrete that they're purchasing, and Israel sells them concrete, because if Israel doesn't, then like shame on you for not doing it. But they sell them concrete knowing they're using it for terror tunnels, instead of taking the money and taking what's being provided to them, using it to create infrastructure and a future for that young generation.
Well, despair and poverty aids those who want to recruit folks to become terrorists. Despair and poverty, they're friends of the terrorists.
I mean, Saudi Arabia did it for 30 plus years. I mean, when you, I think that the new minister of religion in Saudi Arabia finally made a change to that. It was a big deal. It was this huge news report that no one really heard about. But it was an NGO run out of Saudi Arabia that funded extremist madrasas all over the Middle East, in some of the poorest countries and areas. And that's really what sort of created this fire of extremism over the last several decades. And now they're no longer funding it. They're like, listen, we were wrong. We shouldn't have done that. We've got a huge population under the age of 18. We want our population, this next generation, to have, you know, opportunity with technology and science and engineering and math and arts and provide a different life for them.
But I have some real problems with Saudi Arabia.
Oh, of course.
The crown prince. I mean, right. Obviously, we have some real problems with Saudi Arabia, and the current policies of the United States are, to, again, turn a blind eye.
Right. It,
like, oh, yeah, they're great folks. We'll sell them military hardware. We'll do that. These people are not our friends.
Well, I don't want to say that they're not our friends. I think that there are real issues within Saudi Arabia, but there's also real issues in Iran and real issues all around that part of the world. And I think, for me, when I'm looking at Saudi Arabia, I'm trying to at least identify where, in the last year or two, they're trying to bring real reform.
They don't allow criticism.
Right, but you can't look at it from Western eyes, from a Western mindset, is what I'm saying. If you go there and you talk to people in Saudi Arabia, you ask the younger generation about what's happening, they'll begin to tell you about some of the positive things that are starting to happen. Like they're like finally breaking free of some of these restrictions.
I've been in Saudi Arabia right before the first Gulf War with Schwarzkopf, and I was with a group of journalists from Tampa Bay. We were it was one free night we had. We were looking for a specific restaurant. There was a reporter with us, Linda Vester, who went to work for NBC and Fox, who had a graduate degree from the University of Egypt, spoke fluent Arabic, and we were lost. So we ran across a group of Saudi Arabian gentlemen, and I said, Linda, ask them how to get to the restaurant.
She
looked at them, and I asked the question, and they turned to me and started talking to me. Well,
right.
You know, I know bupkis,
right, like, I have no idea what you're saying.
Right.
From
back then in the 90s, and they couldn't drive, and they had to wear the burqas everywhere that they went. Yeah, that's
right.
True.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. I mean, they were the primary sponsors for the last multiple decades of these madrasas that were like feeding off of poverty and extremism, and that's instead of education and different things. So my whole point, that the fact that they would just say, you know what, we're not going to do that anymore, that's a huge step for a country like Saudi Arabia. And I think that goes to your point of poverty. Like the people who are authoritarian in these terrorist organizations, they love to keep people in a place of poverty and desperation because they can then control. And then people have no other hope, and so they just join in and fight. And they're just, whatever you tell me, that's what I'm going to do. And I think that's the sad thing, that you see this vicious cycle. And that's what we see happening with Hamas.
Right. When there's no hope, then you're desperate. And as you say,
right,
they will do anything. One other point I want to make is a lot of people don't realize, I think a lot of Jews do, but maybe don't, 25% of Israel is non-Jewish.
Right.
And the Israeli government is not entirely Jewish. Knesset has Arab members, has all sorts of factions.
And Arab parties.
And that's right.
More than one.
I think there's like 27 parties. I mean, if you think our politics are crazy, just go to Israel, do a master's on Israeli politics. It'll tie you up for years. Even the Knesset, I mean, not the Knesset, the Supreme Court. Has an Arab member. So when people say that Israel is so repressive to Jews, I mean to Arabs, right. You wouldn't have them in the Knesset, the legislative body. You wouldn't have them on the Supreme Court if it was oh so prejudiced. That belies that argument.
Or the universities with their large populations, and I think that's where I encourage people Go into the West Bank, spend time in Israel, talk to people and just see how people live, because Jews and Arabs are living side by side every day there in peace and prosperity and, in businesses and life. And so it's a different mindset. And I think we always want to apply our Western ideas to other countries over there. And it's not fair. We shouldn't do that.
That's right. Well, let's take another little break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit about BDS, which is obviously a hot topic today. You are listening to The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. Listening to The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. I'm Mike Deason.
This is Laureen Jaffe.
And we have a lot still to talk about today. BDF obviously seems to be dominating the conversation. I was pleased to see when the cabinet was over in Israel, they signed that anti-BDS legislation. And I've heard from some of my friends who are big First Amendment people, and Lord knows I am a big First Amendment people. I've been a journalist for more than 50 years, and I truly am a defender of the First Amendment. I mean, it's easy to defend the First Amendment when you believe in what's being said. The hard part is to defend it when you don't like what is being said, but that's what you have to do. And I went to the APEC conference. When was that, Lori?
It was the end of March.
Something like that. I went to cover it. I'm not a member of it. I went to cover it. And one of the people that I talked to is the Assistant Majority Whip of the California Legislature, Jesse Gabriel. He's a really bright guy who not only talks about BDS, but he defended a lawsuit about BDS. This is a guy to watch. I think he is really, he's Jewish, obviously. And I think that he put it in my mind very clear on why this doesn't trample on the First Amendment.
And I'm a big believer in the First Amendment. I think that the opportunity to express and criticize and have public debate is the core of our democracy. It's the core of democracy around the world. It's an essential human freedom. But there's a difference between speech and action, right? And so California has very strong anti-discrimination laws. And we said, you can criticize Israel, but you can't decide not to do business with somebody because of their religion or their nationality. I think it's the difference between speech and action that we look at. And it's the same with our anti-discrimination policy in California across other issues. You can't decide not to rent somebody an apartment because they're black. You can't decide not to do business with somebody because they're Latino. And you also can't decide not to do business with somebody because they're Jewish. That violates our anti-discrimination law. You can say whatever you want, but when it comes to conduct, the state has an opportunity to regulate that.
The other thing that you said I thought was significant, that when you got involved in that suit, that the people who were advocating BDS really weren't interested in the Palestinians. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, so I was involved in this lawsuit against a union of graduate students that had endorsed a BDS measure and an academic boycott of Israel. And one of the ways that we were able to defeat it ultimately is to really expose the viewpoint of the folks that were promoting it. And we looked at their public statements and what they had said. They were against a two-state solution. They were against a resolution that said Jews have a right to self-determination. So they weren't hiding who they are. These are not people who are interested in peaceful coexistence, even though ultimately they may try and present themselves that way. These are people who are against the right of the Jewish people to have rights that every other people in the world should have. And we also exposed some of their theories. I mean, these were people that had, some of them, really deeply anti-Semitic conspiracy theories about Zionists being complicit in the Holocaust. I mean, just crazy stuff. And once we were able to unearth that and present that to folks, it really undermined their efforts to present themselves. Oh, we care about the Palestinians. We care about peace. This is not about peaceful coexistence. This is about delegitimizing and destroying the state of Israel.
Final thing, BDS hurts America. Talk a little bit about that.
Yes, and so one of the other points that we made to get this overturned is demonstrating the way in which BDS would hurt American workers, right? It would deeply impact, boycotting a lot of these American companies that do business in Israel would deeply impact the jobs, the health care, the pensions, retirement security of tens of thousands of women and men in America. And that was something that when the union understood that, they said, there's no way in hell we're going to put the political preferences of a few radical graduate students above the livelihoods and retirement security of our folks who've been working to try and create a better life for them, for themselves and their families.
Jesse Gabriel, I remember that name. I was really impressed with him. What happened, the way that that conference worked, there were breakout sessions, and I would pick ones that I thought were pretty interesting. That was one. I'd listen to the people speak, and then afterwards I'd go up and say, okay, you just said that at that session. Say it again. It was some of the easiest interviews I've ever done because I heard it beforehand. This guy, my prediction is he is going to be on the national scene. I was just enamored with his ability to succinctly say things and make perfect sense. You're going to hear more from him.
From him.
You know what else he told me that really amazed me? In California alone, there are more Latinos than there are Jews in the United States.
That's an amazing word.
That is a staggering figure. I was really amazed. But although
Jews are less than 2% of the U.S. population,
I know. But there are many Latinos right. in California, obviously, which is going to change the whole tenor of the United States. As white males like me, we're going to be in the minority.
Was it the Pew study? Or I was looking at statistics just the other day, and I think whites are no longer 50% or more. I think it was at 48%. Hispanics were in the high 20. African Americans was a lower number than I anticipated. I think
15?
15 or 14%.
So something, yeah.
I thought it was closer to 18 to 20%. Asian Americans was actually a higher number than I was expecting. Not as significant as the Hispanic Americans, but larger than the African American Americans. And then, of course, the Muslim Americans are a smaller percent than the Jews, and the Jews being a little less than 2%. So, really some interesting statistics is going to change dynamics for elections going forward. But he's amazing. I mean, I love what he said about the First Amendment and really breaking it down on as far as, look, we're not, you want to express his opinions, that's fine.
Exactly.
But when you're conducting business and doing different things like what we just talked about in that article we were reading earlier today on News for Jews.
I love that. I love that. We need a little jingle.
News for Jews. But when you're reading this percent, like 20% of people think it's okay not to serve a Jew, and then going down and also other minorities, and that's frightening. But you know what? Okay, fine. You know what? That's your personal opinion. You want to be a racist? You want to be a bigot? Okay.
You have a First Amendment right to say that.
Right. But guess what? You can't actually conduct business that way. You can't deny someone. You can't refuse to serve them because of that. Sorry. So I'm really glad that he said that. I think also what he said about the BDS intentions, I mean, that goes to some of the comments I think I've made in the last show. When you look at the founder of BDS, Omar Bugatti, I mean, he's been very clear in many statements over the years that he has no interest in a two-state solution. His desire is to see the Israel state not exist in Palestine. That is gone. And I think that's true. That goes to, what I've seen what our students on college campuses have seen when they confront SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, which really is like a front for BDS on campus. The violent rhetoric, the hate coming out of their mouths, and the horrific accusations against these Jewish students. It's not based upon, you know, really, number one, actual knowledge and understanding of what's happening on the ground in Gaza and the West Bank. And it's not really about curing issues that they see as being unjust or human rights violations. It's really sort of a hate-based organization of get rid of Israel.
Yeah, Bugatti wants a secular state. And he says one state solution. That is totally, in my mind, and most of the people on the scene say that is totally untenable.
Well, it's not tenable. I mean, and to ask the Israelis to live with people who have been sworn to their destruction, who have said, you know, that they are completely sworn to their destruction. You know, there are organizations, there are Hamas and others. And then you're raising a generation. I don't know if, you know, the viewers have ever seen, but Mamri, M-E-M-R-I, puts out undercover videos that take place over in Gaza pretty frequently, and you see these.
Wait, I'm not familiar with this.
So it's an organization that they do undercover videos and they'll report on what's happening. So there are Hamas has put together, and you can go on YouTube, and I've seen them. Like, they have a program that's like Sesame Street, but it's not Sesame Street. Like, it's teaching little 3-year-olds, you know, to go stab a Jew.
Seriously?
Yes, or carrying Uzis. Like, what do you want to be when I want to be a suicide bomber. I mean, this is what these little kids, so you now have the generation, you have these children, and to me, that's horrific, blatant child abuse. This is child abuse. And so you're seeing the uncovering of some of these educational programs that Hamas is using to brainwash these children, and then you're saying, my God, how in the world are they going to be able to live side by side in peace with people that they've been taught since their earliest days to hate?
Tell me the name of that organization again.
It's M-E-M-R-I.
M-E-M-R-I.
And I can't remember what the acronym stands
for. But you can find it.
Yes, you can YouTube and you can find those videos. And in fact, you know what? Maybe what we'll do in the next show, we'll play one.
Yeah, because I'm sure from the audio we can...
pick up enough, right? You'll miss the visual, but from the audio you can definitely get... You can get the sense of what's happening, yeah.
Wow, that blows me away. One other part of the emails that we got that were critical were, again, about BDS and the First Amendment. And one of the people that talked about the fact, the email said, well, the ACLU has come out against BDS, says it's an inhibitor on First Amendment rights. Again, same type of thing. We had the opportunity, Sherry Silberman, who's a special correspondent for our show, had an opportunity to interview Alan Dershowitz, who personally, I think, has gone off the deep end. I think he's a brilliant lawyer. I think, and I'm sure you're a wonderful lawyer, but you would not want to face him in court, Lorene. The guy is a great...
No, he's brilliant.
He's brilliant.
He's a brilliant lawyer.
But I think he's gone off the deep end. But I think he's right on point about why the ACLU is wrong and why he believes that BDS does not violate the First Amendment.
Currently pending in Congress is the Israel Anti-Boycott Act of 2017. The ACLU has openly written letters twice opposing the bill on the grounds that it would unconstitutionally target political boycotts for criminal penalties, thereby infringing on First Amendment activities. What's your response to the ACLU's position?
Well, the ACLU has been on the other side of that issue over and over again. They have supported legislation that bans discrimination. What's the difference between BDS and somebody who says, I won't deal with African Americans, or I won't deal with gay people, or I won't deal with Muslims? The ACLU has not been particularly responsive to free speech issues recently, but they picked on this issue because many on the hard left support BDS. But as long as the BDS legislation doesn't prohibit advocacy of BDS, it only prohibits active economic boycotts, it's perfectly constitutional.
So, he agrees with Jesse Gabriel without a doubt. You can say bad things, but you can't put that into action. To me, that makes so much sense, and I can't understand why people can't put in blacks, gays, whomever, instead of Jews. These same people who are advocating BDS are saying that it's okay to discriminate against Jews. And I don't understand. They would never, never say that you could do that with a black or a gay or a Hispanic.
Right. I think that, look, he's making his point. I mean, I personally don't think Dershowitz has gone off the deep end. I mean, I know a lot of friends who think he's a traitor and he's done, traitor to the Democratic Party and different things. But, he was here earlier this year for the Federation's annual event. And for me, Dershowitz has always been a very thoughtful leader. He's a very thoughtful lawyer. He's a Harvard professor. He is looking at things differently than a lay person will look at it. What he's always looking at, and what I hear, and where my ear sort of is listening, is the law. And he's looking at the application of the law in a particular situation. And he's also looking at the consequence. Like, if you want to set that precedent because it serves you at this moment in time, understand the greater consequence. Like, maybe you want something right now because Trump is president, but I'm telling you, 6 years or 4 years or 8 years from now, you may say that was a bad idea.
I agree 100% on that. That the some things that the Republicans are doing now, that they will rue the day, because history shows us there's going to be a Democratic president someday. There's going to be a Democratic Senate and House, and yeah, they will rue the day on some of the decisions that they've made.
Absolutely. And so I think that's just real. I think from my perspective, I've always felt like that's really where Dershowitz is coming from. So I just had to say that because I know you said that you thought he went off the deep end, but I agree with him completely on what he's saying about BDS and his comments on the ACLU. And quite frankly, I was very surprised by the ACLU's position. I read their legal memoranda on the issue, and it was the same argument they made to the Supreme Court on the initial Arab boycott legislation, and the U.S. Supreme Court struck it down. It's dealing with the Commerce Clause in the United States. It's dealing with issues beyond just the First Amendment. And when you're dealing with commerce, the restrictions on First Amendment are a little different than you're dealing with personal free speech, and the government's ability to regulate commerce is very important there. So it's a different legal argument. It's a different concept that people aren't necessarily grasping onto when they're like, oh, it's First Amendment. But the ACLU knows that. I mean, these are very intelligent, qualified, skilled lawyers. So I'm very surprised by some of the arguments they've made. But I agree with what Dershowitz said there.
Now, one of the emails I got about BDS was they said Martin Luther King boycotted businesses that wouldn't do business with blacks. And they said, well, if Martin Luther King could do that, why can't people do that who are not happy about Israel?
Like, look, it's because it's not about people who want to boycott those businesses. If you don't want to go buy something from a particular business that's doing business in Israel, guess what? You don't have to. But the legislation goes beyond that. The legislation and the sort of the BDS movement is not just about telling you, what you can or cannot do. I mean, BDS is the whole idea that we don't want these businesses and the U.S. businesses working in Israel, and great, then you don't have to do it, but don't tell those companies they can't be there. They're public companies. They could be wherever they want. You don't have to buy their products. It's as simple as that.
Absolutely, and that's what the Florida legislation says, that, well, okay, you want to boycott Israel? You do have the right to do that, but we also have the right not to do business with you. When the person made the Martin Luther King argument to me about people boycotting the businesses, they were boycotting businesses that did not cater to blacks, that wouldn't serve blacks or made them sit at separate counters and all.
Sure.
So businesses have the freedom to do that, but then they can't come back to the state of Florida and say, I want you to buy my product. And that's basically what the Florida law says, what the California law says, and why I think that there is credence to the argument that BDS does not violate the First Amendment at all.
No, and look, I mean, you mean the anti-BDS legislation.
I mean the I'm sorry.
Anti-BDS legislation.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, and look, I do it in my own personal life. There are businesses that I will not do business with. There are people that, I'm not going to spend money to go see or hear because of anti-Semitic stances they've taken. So, and that's a personal choice of mine. I'm saying, then I don't want to do that. But the the anti-BDS legislation was never intended to stop me or stop you or stop any individual from doing that. We have that choice and we have that right. I mean, it's so that it doesn't impact our personal right to do that.
For example, there's a current issue going on in this country. The owner of Yuengling Beer, which is a growing beer, came out and endorsed Trump. Sales have fallen off. People have boycotted. They have every right to do that.
Right.
But so be it. But the state doesn't have to do business with some.